Is that your guy? What your guy said?
Well, he's on most of second. It's supposed to be third year, but I guess. Something we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah. So why don't I get these in advance if you're ready? If I gave them 4 months in advance, why did they get them 4 months? Why did they get them? They must have done.
They don't do it.
In Kedusha,
right?
You can't email them to them? Okay, we'll talk about this. Okay, guys, let's start. How long do we have for Rabbi? 2:30?
2:30. It's at 2:40, but I have a question.
Okay, I was asked to speak on end-of-life issues. The discussion here, although it could easily take that direction, is not going to focus on the notion of organ donation, brain death, cessation of heart, and stuff like that, because I understand there will be others who will speak about those important topics. And it is a natural progression of some of the issues that we'll be discussing here. But there'll be more than enough for us to discuss. So when discussing the end-of-life issues, I think before we get into the nekudas that I mentioned here, it's important to recognize whether you're going to go into chinuch or rabbanus, whether you're going to, as the president calls it, become lay kodesh. So the bottom line is that I think the etzem nekuda of anything to do with end-of-life issues for somebody who has to relate to a family is to recognize that sensitivity is the overarching agenda item. You have to be sensitive. A family is going through this. The parent could be 121 years old. It doesn't really make a difference, even if they're expecting to die for the past year. It doesn't make a difference. You can expect anything you want. The person could be on life support for 2 years and anything else of that nature. It's a challenging situation when a person has to deal with the death of a loved one, whether it's a parent, whether, God forbid, it's a child or a spouse or anything else of that nature. That's number one. Number two is, you have to realize that when a family is going through a crisis like this, they don't always have the capacity to process as effectively and as you would expect them, even if they might be, you know, organizational psychologists, and they're normally very focused and very detailed. But bottom line is, when something of this nature hits home, all of the professional components of one's life often get compromised, and one's ability to effectively deal with the issue is challenged. And that's really where the rabbi comes in a host of different ways. And even if one becomes, from this perspective, one is not on the front lines of this, let's say one is a principal of a school and stuff of that nature, it's also important to understand some of these issues because a parent that is involved in the school, a parent who has children in the school, this is an issue that affects the whole family. It's important to have some understanding of these issues. So with that in mind, let me just mention one other thing, and that is something that I did not include in the Makorot because I wasn't planning on discussing it, even though it is extremely important. And I actually, maybe I will present them in Makorot in a different framework because I have an interesting set of Makorot. Several years ago, I was asked to speak on behalf at a Nefesh conference on issues of truth-telling to patients and what the halachas are. And I had an interesting guest in the audience, and the person took a set of source material, and then wrote ha'aros, most of them pretty positive, and then submitted to me back with that person's ha'aros. That person was no less than Rav Herschel Schachter. So sometimes when I hand out these ha'aros, I don't hand out mine anymore, I just hand out the one with all his ha'aros on it. So we can study his ha'aros, and then we look at my sources. But the bottom line is that the issue of truth-telling to patients is an important issue, and I'd like to spend a few minutes on it, and we can introduce it in some of the aspects of what we're going to discuss here. So let's open this up. My understanding is that all of you have gone through this in great detail already. Therefore, we just have to do it in the summary level. But just in case one or two of you haven't gone through them yet or haven't seen them before 5 minutes ago, why don't we spend a few minutes going through this? It wouldn't kill us to basically review some of this stuff in advance. It would be in your best interest, because then I can use this, as I was planning on, as a springboard to discuss issues in much greater depth, as opposed to getting you to, you know, bulk up on the sources, which curtails the wherewithal to discuss this in a more larger way. So we're going to do something somewhere in between the two. We'll go through the sources, but we're not going to go through them in every single detail. But the source is Osios Machkimos. It's very important, especially when we're studying with individuals who are Talmidei Chachamim, that we see the sources, and it's not something that's just taken for granted, a lecture without sources. So let's open up to the first page. The first page reminds us, the Gemara, the Bavli, Maseches Avodah Zarah, reminds us the idea that a mace is Asur Bahana. This idea that it's Asur Bahana is something that's important, because it reminds us that there's a certain holiness to the body even after death, and therefore we have to be careful with the body. Therefore, not only is there an issue with Isur Bahana, there's an issue of Kavod HaMeis. I've always tried to explain this philosophically as the idea that Judaism recognizes, unlike Christianity, that sometimes suggests that the, and it's quoted in the New Testament, sources that I did not bring down in this handout, that suggests that the body is what causes the individual to sin. We actually look at it much differently. We look at it that the body is the conduit through which the neshama achieves shleimus. We look at it as a way in which we're able to achieve shleimus hanefesh through the mitzvahs that the body is able to do. Because we have such respect for the body, because we realize, as Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, that holiness is rooted in the mundane, not in the ethereal concepts. It's rooted in the mundane, that it's important to recognize that we treat the body with a certain amount of holiness. And even posthumously, when the body can no longer act as a conduit of being able to achieve mitzvot, while that loss of possibility is the reason why it is the avi avot tuma, because tuma is directly related to the issue of loss of creativity. A woman has the menstrual cycle, she's considered to have some level of tuma because there's a whisper of death. The whisper of death is the potential that there was to have an egg fertilized. When a woman gives birth, if she carries a zachar, she has one component of tuma. She carries in the keva, it's twice that amount, simply because when she carries in the keva, she's not only carrying a new human being, but she's carrying a new human being that has potential to create new human beings. So when that potential, when that status quo is lost, when she gives birth, although she may be very ecstatic that she's given birth, but her status quo creativity has changed, and therefore tuma sets in. So when it comes to misa, tuma is the quintessential form of tuma. But we also recognize the fact that the mace, the body, has been used to achieve holiness, and therefore we treat it with respect. That's why we, you know, are so against any issues of cremation. That's why, which is another discussion that we should once have, regarding how do families deal with the fact they became from, and all of a sudden, I had this week, I just don't remember where, but I had this week, all of a sudden, what happens is that the family realizes that they, the family realizes that the parents want to be, the parents want to be cremated, and the children refuse to do the cremation, and all the challenges of that nature, which are important challenges to recognize. So, with that in mind, it's important to realize that there is an Isser Hana regarding a mace, and that halacha is also concretized in the Shulchan Aruch. Mace, Beit Ovid Kechavim, Beit Yisrael, Tachricha, Asurim, Bahana. That the issue is that not only is the mace Asur Bahana, but anything on the mace might be considered Asur Bahana. You know, you can't. If the woman has a ring on her, a watch on her, that's not an Isur Hana, but if she has a gold filling or something like that, that's Asur Bahana. And then, with that in mind, yes?
it's similar to the notion of body-soul unification, like Aristotle and how the Rambam understands it, and therefore we don't really see a significant difference between a live person and a dead person with regard to the kavod?
No, I think actually we recognize the fact, and I'm not sure it's exactly what Aristotle felt, and I'm not convinced the Rambam felt like Aristotle on this issue, but that's definitely not the point of this discussion right now. But I think the issue of greater concern here is that there is this notion that a mace, that we treat the mace with there is a notion of kavod hamace. I think that paradigm is obviously felt when a person is alive, but I think it's given extra emphasis at a time in which one might think that since there's now a division between the mace, between the neshama and the body, that you don't have to treat the body with holiness, we're saying that it's with the conduit of kedusha, therefore it needs to be treated with holiness. I'm not sure I answered your question, though. The issue now also is, because of this kavod hamace, there's also an iser of linas hamace. We don't want the mace to stay over time too long. This issue was primarily a major issue when we didn't have refrigeration. When we have refrigeration, it's a little bit easier. But the normal protocol is, which is not followed in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, they don't really care if you get to the funeral or not. The normal protocol of linas hamace is that if the relatives that are sitting shiva need to take an extra day, someone's in California, someone's here, someone's there, they'll normally wait for the relatives that are sitting shiva before they'll do the funeral. Eretz Yisrael, there isn't that much of a consideration for those issues. The Chevra Kadishas there are pretty aggressive in the way they deal with that, and that's because there are special halachas regarding in Eretz Yisrael, also regarding linas hamace. But they're pretty concerned about these issues. If a person is on a different flight from the nifter, and if you don't do it soon, you'll miss the day, and they bury at night also. They won't wait, even if it's a child. They won't wait. It's a very interesting experience to deal with the Chevra Kadishas in Eretz Yisrael. They are. It's an interesting experience. Okay. With this in mind, however, this issue of kavod hamace, that's really the point in which we say any type of dissecting of a mace, any type of autopsies for a mace, here is a major issue, is something that we forbid because of the fact that we don't want to compromise kavod hamace. Now, you will find that there are certain cases in which, due to the laws of the land, you won't be able to fight autopsies. If you live in like Muncie or something like that, where basically the medical examiner is kafuf to the community, it's sometimes a little bit easier to deal with the issue. But in most places around the country, there are certain protocols in which a medical examiner will start to get involved in. And you know, if a person is, God forbid, killed in a car accident, so sometimes the medical examiner will demand to do some type of autopsy. Wants to make sure the person wasn't drinking, wants to make sure it was the other person's fault. I remember several years ago in Century Village Deerfield, for those who don't know of the holy Century Village Deerfield, there are hundreds and hundreds of people. Let's put it this way, when I go there, I get psicha for Anam Zmiras. I do Anam Zmiras when I go there. So the bottom line is that it's an interesting community, but it's a lot of people. The Kol does a Daf Yomi there every day, they get 60 people. Like 20, 30 of them are retired Ravanim, which is a challenge for any guy who gives a Daf Yomi. But the bottom line is that what happened once, Rahman al-Islam, there was a guy crossing the street and he got hit by a truck. And they found that the truck is supposed to have like 10 different brake systems, like on each one of the wheels, and 7 out of the 10 brake systems were not functional. So the medical examiner wanted to do an autopsy on this old yid, because he felt maybe the yid was drunk. But that didn't make any sense. I mean, 7 out of the 10 brake systems weren't working. Why are you checking whether the guy, when he crossed the street, may not have been intoxicated? Maybe it was his fault. You know, 7 out of 10 brake systems weren't functional. So between Rabbi Davis and myself, we worked with the medical examiner that basically they did a cursory check and a blood test and not cut open the person in a way that was mamish nipple hamase. But if Rachmana Litzlan, it happened that a child, let's say, died at a certain event or something like that, there is no amount of rabbinic intervention that will stop an autopsy. In those cases, I suggest, and I would, it's a good thing to keep in mind, that what you do is you get a firm doctor to be present for the autopsies. If the firm doctor is present for the autopsies, he'll make sure, she will make sure, of a few different things. Number one is, and you'll excuse me for being very graphic in this way, that all the parts are put back into the body. And number two is that when the cuttings are made and the stitching up is done, it's not done in a, you know, you can open a body and check around and stitch up in a very nice way, or you can open a body and check around and then stitch up with, you know, wide stitches just to be yotze so that the pieces don't fall out. Obviously, Kavod HaMeis would require us to do things in a way in which we evaluate any necessity for intruding into the body. And if you have a firm physician in the room, I have found that that changes the sensitivity issues. They see how sensitive you are, they become very sensitive themselves. Once members of your Chevra Kadisha have a full understanding of that issue, it doesn't even have to be a firm physician. It could be someone from the Chevra Kadisha that's holding in these issues and understands the sensitivities and also the medical components. But the note of Yehuda here gives us an example of a case in which an autopsy would be permitted. The note of Yehuda in the 1700s is introduced to a case in which a person died of a certain type of stomach issue, if my memory serves me correctly, that's what the tshuva said, speaking about, or some type of issue. And what happens is that they feel that by doing an autopsy, they will be able to solve the problem of the illness for others who are dying of the same illness at that point in time. Again, it would have been nice if you guys read this tshuva, and you should still read this tshuva. This is the seminal tshuva on any issues with autopsy. This is the tshuva. You cannot talk about the notion of autopsies and halacha without this tshuva. It all begins from this note of Yehuda. So you guys really need to read this tshuva. And the note of Yehuda discusses the idea of that is not considered nivel hames. And I highlighted this in the pieces that I took the time to underline. It's not nivel hames. Why is it not nivel hames? Because by doing an autopsy in this case, you're not compromising the dead person. You are once again allowing the body to be a conduit of mitzvahs by allowing somebody else's life to be saved. It's a form of pikuach nefesh. This individual posthumously is fulfilling the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. It's not nivel, and therefore it's not a bizayon, and therefore it is permitted. But the note of Yehuda puts very limited, puts strong conditions on this. It can't be that there might be somebody in the future that's dying of this, or you want to do scientific research on this. This issue of Kavod HaMeis, which is a particular issue of Kavod HaMeis that's limited to our Jews, which requires a philosophical understanding of why there is a difference between Kavod HaMeis to Jews and non-Jews, which if we have the time, I really would like to discuss. It is important for the note of Yehuda reminds us of the fact that it can't be that you're just doing it for scientific research. It can't be that a person is not in front of you that has the same challenge. So the note of Yehuda's permission to do autopsy is only in a specific case. I remember several years ago there was a family that lost a child to a form of seizures and things of that nature, and the Shomer Shabbos doctor wanted there to be an autopsy because he was worried about the fact that the other future children would suffer from the same problem. He needed to know what the problem was. So that does not totally fit within the categories of the Nodav Yehuda, because the Nodav Yehuda says that the person has to be muta lefanav. But however, in discussing it with Postman, they permitted the autopsy in that case, limited autopsy, because of the fact that they were sure that the future children might have a challenge, and who wants future children of a couple to, no one wants a couple to lose any child, let alone more than one. But it's important to recognize that the Note of Yehuda has strong limitations on his permission. His permission is only when the mace, that the person who's sick is muta lefanav, and then he does permit you to do what you need to do. Okay? Let's go to the next. That's page 1 and page 2. With this in mind, With this in mind, we still have to recognize the fact that somebody who is a gosei, someone who is towards the end of their life, someone who is may die in a few hours from now, one cannot do anything to cause the death to happen in a faster way. And the Rambam, on the top of page 3, highlights that idea by suggesting that it's Lener Shemitatev, even though the way this has it says Leger Shemitatev, the third line is a mistake in the Bar Ilan response literature, but it's Lener Shemitatev, that what's happening is that a candle is at the end of its at the bottom of its, where all the wax has been used up and things of that nature, and it's at a point in which it's about to blow out and struggling still to stay alive, the fire, the candle, the light, that's what a gosei is also, and you can't extinguish it by blowing it out, by doing something in a proactive way that hastens death. With this in mind, it's important to be introduced to a few other halakhic protocols, and that is the notion of chaye shah. There is this idea, and this is what a gosei is all about, that every moment of life is considered important. So we are concerned not only with life in general, but chaye shah, even the life for a small period of time. With that in mind, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah needs to give you a special matir in the following case. Let's say there's a case in which you have no physicians that can save the guy except for an anti-Semitic physician. So and you're not sure if the guy's going to really help you or not. So Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, Amar Rav Chisa, Amar Rav Yochanan, Safik Chai, Safik Meis. If you're not sure whether the person is going to live or die, aim is rapping me him. You don't want to use this guy because he might cause the person to die. Vade meis, if you know the person is definitely going to die, he'll die in a day from now, he'll die in 2 days from now. So then we say you're permitted to allow Misrafim Mehem. You're permitted to allow this anti-Semitic doctor, this person who doesn't embrace Jews all the time, to have a look at him. So the Gemara says Meis. So okay, the guy will die. Ha'ika chayesha, but every moment counts, as we indicate in the laws of Goseis. So the answer is the chayesha lo chashinan. There are times in which we don't consider chayesha. Even though halakhically you're not allowed to cause life to end prematurely, you can't, say, and this might sound like a joke, but I'm telling you, I've seen cases like this, where somebody, a person comes down from Florida and says to the doctor, I'm here for the weekend, my father's going to die anyways, can we just get this over before I go back for the weekend, things of that nature. You cannot believe the thing that one parent can raise, 10 children, and 10 children can't deal with one parent. Unfortunately, maybe not in our circles, Baruch Hashem, but in other circles, it can really be an issue. So you're not allowed to do anything aggressively, but there are times in which chaye shah, the living for a certain period of time, is not considered consequential. When is that? So by the way, Tosos, by the way, in Sefer Avodah Zarah asks, the chayisha lo chashinan, v'hadarmina v'yoma, mefachtim ala v'pagal, that on Shabbos, if there is a person who is found under debris, you're allowed to call in the heavy equipment, even if the person's only going to live for a few hours. So the Tosfos says, alma chashinan, so that means that we do worry about chayisha. The ikila meimar, the hacha v'hasam avinam v'tovaso, the hasam in lo tachosh yamush, v'hachem tachosh lo yirapim in obikachavim, v'ari yamut, V'kan, shavkinen havadei l'mevet hasafek. So Tosfos says, in our case, and this is a very important paradigm that we'll see in other poskim in a few moments, in our case, with the doctor, with the anti-Semitic doctor, if we leave the person alone, we know the person is going to die, it's worth the risk to allow him to see this anti-Semitic doctor, although the doctor might compromise his life for a short period of time, there's a chance the doctor will heal him and the person will live for a long period of time. So it's not that we're not worried about every moment of life, but when there is a challenge between living a long time and it might put at risk living for a short period of time, we go for the living the long period of time. This is discussed in two major tshuvas, in many tshuvas, but in two that I brought down here, Rav Chaim Ozer Gradinsky, the Achi Ezer, and Shvus Yaakov, Rav Reischer. They both really, it's the same tshuva, it's just the different paradigms of it. And let's just read the tshuva on the bottom of page 3 for a second. somebody who is about to die, and there's a Rofe Mumcha who says, "Achor Rofim Omdim Shavada Yamut Toch Yom Yamayim, he might die in a day or two." But they say that maybe there is some type of medicine he can take, that if he takes this medicine, he'll be saved. But if the medicine doesn't work, he might die in 2 hours. So we know he'll live for sure for 2 days. Can he take this medicine? Can he do this operation that might cause him to die on the table? But the flip side is he might live for a very long time. And in both cases, using this Gemara in Avodah Zarah as the major principle, if you look at page 4, it says that in Kain Gam Kain the Didon Zeh Kim Shavani Yamut, since we know he'll die, based on the Gemara that we read, that we are willing to be tofes the suffek, maybe the doctor's medicine will be a good medicine, but it's always good to get a second opinion to make sure that this is the right medicine and that the guy's really a mumcha. This same idea happens in Rav Chaim Oz Grudinsky, B'davar HaSheila, Asher Sha'al, the person asked, about a chola, about rofim, mumchim, omrim, still on page 4, ki below, and here's a pretty hard Hebrew word, ki below operation, right? Nituach, lo yichye yotem shisha chadashim. Can the person have an operation that might cause him to die and lose his 6 months of life? Is this like a gosate that you're causing to die prematurely? Is this compromising chaye shah? And here again, the Achiezer of Chaim Oz Grudinsky answers on the bottom of page 4 that, I don't know where the tshuva is here. Rav Chaim does answer exactly what I just told you, and that is that it is mutter to it's mutter to do the operation, and you don't have to worry about the fact that the guy might die on the table. Halachically, it's permitted for you to do that. Yeah, please.
So who decides when you have a questionable gamble?
I think then you need to. So there are two questions that need to be asked. We haven't finished showing you the whole picture. The question is, does the patient have a right to make that decision? Obviously, I think the answer is yes, the patient has the right to make that decision. And can the patient opt out and say, no, I don't want to do the operation, which I think he has a right to do also. And the next question becomes, in cases in which the person might live for a longer period of time, but what will happen is there'll be no quality of life, do you have to do any operation of this nature? And the final question is, you know, how do you gather this information? I think that question we can already answer. You know, you use your doctors, you try to find the best, and based on their understanding of the issue, if they're the ones advocating for this procedure and feel that the person could live for an extended period of time, then I think the answer is that you're allowed to do the procedure, even though it might cause the person to die immediately.
Is there any room for ethical experts / a rub?
100%. The Rav is the choreographer of this thing. He's the one who plays the role of explaining that it's permitted for one to do this aggressive procedure, even though it might cause the person to die. And the Rav then becomes the person who supports the family once they make that decision. And if, God forbid, the decision does not work out right, the Rav is there to tell the family that, you know, that you made the right decision, even though it may not have worked out the way you wanted it, and gives the family the support necessary to be able to feel that they made the decision. I've always felt when these decisions are made that the whole family should make the decision. Like, for example, you always have cases where, especially in Florida, where you'll have maybe one member of the children live, one of the children live, and the other children live somewhere else, and they'll basically say, well, you make the decision. That's a bad thing, because that person's going to blame themselves that they made the decision. I always encourage that they all talk amongst each other and they all make the decision together. In fact, even though sometimes it's only one child has to sign the form to permit the operation if there's no spouse and things of that nature, I also actually encourage that if there is a form like that, that every child would sign that form. Because if it doesn't go well, it shouldn't be that the person who actually has put in the most time, energy, and effort, the one who's in there during that crisis mode, the quarterback, so to say, the whole thing, shouldn't feel if it doesn't go well that he or she was the failure in the process. That's just the practical rabbinics component. Yes?
Is
what the doctor said that, I mean, it's not like, it seems from the shoe that it's more clear cut, like, he could die on an operating table or he could live another 20 years.
Yeah.
What if it's like, chances are he's not going to make it, he's going to die for sure in a month. Chances are I can do an operation, chances are he'll die on an operating table, but if it goes well, which I'm not counting on, but it can, he'll live.
So I think again, it's very hard in the sterile environment of a classroom to discuss this, but I think that you have to ask the doctor that, there, I think there's a few other components. Will there be better quality of life? What is the quality of life now? So if we can just hold your question for another half an hour, and then we'll get back to it, okay? It's an important question. Yes?
At this point, are we saying that it mutter to sacrifice Tayesha for potential?
Yes.
Or you're chayav to do the procedure?
No, I don't think the tshuva is required that you do it. They give you the permission to...
If there's a possibility of, let's say, saving the person, why aren't you obligated to...
Why aren't you obligated to do that? Well, if we look at the tshuva of the Shavuos Yaakov, I don't get the... I mean, it's leaning towards the fact that you really should do it, but I don't see... It says, you know, Kim Shavadiyah B'manich Mavadiyah B'tosim HaSafek. I never got the opinion that you mamish had to do it. And also, I think there's another issue here that is extremely important, which we haven't yet touched, and that is the notion of quality of life, which is an important component in it, and is, there's no, it's a very important component. So I'd like to, again, I think those questions are very similar. If we could just wait a few more moments, and then let's address the question again. But I personally, the way I read these tshuvas, If there was no quality of life issues, that the guy's going to be able to play golf, run, do whatever he wants, smile with his kids and enjoy his grandchildren and all that other stuff, or even only just smile with his kids and won't need a feeding tube, won't need to be on oxygen, won't need to be on this, won't need to be on that, so then I think the issue is that you should do the surgery. I give you an example of a case, but we're going slightly ahead of where I wanted to go. What? I'll do it anyway, so it's just... get this over, then we'll go work back into this. Again, I just don't remember if I did this. There was a guy in the shul who was on a procedure that's not such a difficult procedure. He's on a procedure in which his kidneys were not functioning. So he was on a procedure in which they were cleaning his blood, and the memory escapes me of what it's called. Blood dialysis. The guy decided after a while that he did not want to continue dialysis because he felt the quality of his life was being, he was totally in control of his life, and his quality of his life was being severely compromised. I did not feel, so he wanted to stop dialysis, so he came to me and asked me my opinion. I did not feel that I had the wherewithal to tell him that he could stop dialysis, because I don't consider that like a real, you know, major operation type of thing. It's like a standard procedure. But it was true that his life was being impaired in a whole bunch of different ways because of the dialysis. So I met with the whole family, and I posed the question to Rav Schechter, and Rav Schechter permitted him to stop dialysis. And the person died after, you know, a week or two. The guy was clearly not wanting to do this operation, which is not really an aggressive operation, but it got to a point where he felt that he was not he wasn't in control of his life. It wasn't just the 3 or 4 times a week that he'd do it. It would slow him down. He felt he was in pain. He felt he wasn't always lucid. That's not the way he wanted to live his life, and that's predicated on what we're about to do right now. Yeah.
I'm just understanding the case. How many hours a day was he in the procedure?
Not that many hours a day. Was it 3-4 hours a day?
Three times a week.
Yeah. We got to go on a little bit further here. I'm sorry. I'm trying to got to be a little strict on getting through the material. So, page 5. By the way, guys, if I don't answer all your questions, which you know, in case you don't know, I actually work here now. So I'm more than willing to meet with any of you and spend some more time dealing with these issues. We can create maybe a little roundtable discussion and talk about these issues anytime as mutually convenient, it would be my privilege to do so. So, but it's really important that, you know, we get through this material, because I just told you half a story, and it's intellectually dishonest that we don't really finish the stuff. So the next piece of the puzzle is based on the Gemara Ksuvos, where Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was at a point in his life in which he was very ill, and he was being kept alive due to the tefillot of the community that on a regular basis would pray for him. However, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's maidservant saw how his life, how his quality of life was being compromised. And while initially she was totally supportive of all of the prayers on behalf of her boss, the person that she, you know, took care of in a, you know, in a significant way, she changed her mind, and she basically realized that once he was being mitztayer, he ratzon, she said that the wishes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he be taken should override the wishes of his students who are praying for his continued refuah shleima. But the rabbis wouldn't stop praying, so what she did was she went to the roof, she dropped a pitcher, it came smashing down on the floor. When it came smashing down on the floor, everyone stopped for a second. At that moment, the tefillot stopped, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died. Ishtekei merachmei benoach nafshei de Rebbe. Now the Ran in the Darim highlights this also, and the Ran says something very interesting. And the Ran says, Nir ve'enai dehachi kamar pa'amim shetzarech levakesh rachamim alachoa sheyamus. Sometimes you have to pray for the person to die. Kegon shemitzara chola v'cholav harbe. The person is being mitzara due to his illness. Ve'yef shalosh yechye. We don't want him to live like that. Kedavrinan, as the story goes, v'perkanos, the Gemara in Ksuvos that I just told you about, the Kivin the Chazi Amasa de Rebbe, since the mates of a Rebbe was seeing what she was going through, she prayed that he would die, and that's why Mshumachi Kamar Damavaka Chola Mo'ila B'Tfilaso, and then the idea being that that sometimes, you know, the prayer is not that the person should be misrafet, but rather HaKadosh Baruch Hu should create an environment in which there's no pain. This idea is highlighted by the Shulchan Aruch also, where the Shulchan Aruch says that while it's usher to be goreim the mace to die early, which means the following. Let's say there's a person who has no quality of life and the person's on a respirator. You don't have the right to turn off the respirator. You don't have the right to turn it off and say, okay, you know, game over, the person has no quality of life, we just turn it off. Even though medically, the doctors might be willing to do it in certain situations when there's a flat EEG, which means that there is no upper brain function. They might be willing to do it when the person has no quality of life. But we would not permit in any way, shape, or form, not Rabbi Tendler, not Rabbi Schechter, in the protocols I just established to you, no one would permit the closing of a respirator in that situation when there's just a flat EEG. However, avo im yesh davar shegorim iku v'tzias hanefesh kagon sheyesh samach la'oso bias kol dofei kagon choded etzim or something else of that nature. Like, for example, the guy is about to die, but the noise outside is keeping him alive. You're allowed to stop that because that's not considered a ma'aseh of causing death to die to be hastened. Definition of what's prohibited is doing something to the mace, moving the mace around, covering the mace, taking off oxygen, you know, doing anything of that nature. That is what's forbidden. Now, let's just keep in mind a few things, because I think it is important that we discuss a little bit halacha l'maaseh here before we develop this idea of quality of life. So sometimes you can have a situation in which the person will have no quality of life. As we will see in a few moments, you can pray for the person's death. But praying for the person's death does not mean you can turn off a respirator. What it does mean, however, is if the person's on certain medications, which are normally IV medications, while you can't pull off the IVs, you can't just unplug the IVs and call it a day, you can, once the bags have been completed, you don't have to refill them. In other words, let's say they're on an IV antibiotic. So that IV antibiotic is stopping the spread of certain type of disease within the person. So removing that antibiotic is halakhically forbidden because you're doing something proactively that causes the person to die. But once the bag of antibiotics is complete, putting in a different bag is a heroic measure. That's a kumva ase, that's not required either. In other words, what I mean to say is a kumva ase, to remove the bag, is forbidden. A sheva al tasa, once the bag is completed, is not required either. So what?
So
that's where this issue.
What? Pikuach nefesh you can be doing.
It's not pikuach nefesh when there's no quality of life. That's the chiddush of this whole thing. Because we're not up to there yet. What?
We're not up to there.
Yeah, but what's that's the issue. Lo tamar adar v'yecha does not mean when the person has no quality of life. The person's going to be a vegetable. It's going to eat from a peg. It's going to eat from something in their stomach or something else of that nature. That's not considered quality of life. If a person feels that they don't have quality of life, you do not need to aggressively maintain any forms of medicine and stuff like that. Yes?
Is it significant in the Gemara that unless the Rebbe actually did something proactive, she actually took a rock or a jug and dropped it off the roof?
Yeah, she did something proactive, but not to the body of the person itself. She did something proactive to create a circumstance, but she didn't do anything proactive to the body itself. That would have been forbidden. Okay? Yes?
So, you can't do anything proactive, so you can withhold somebody who is a vegetable who's breeding on their own, but you can withhold the feeding tube from them?
So the question is whether you can starve a person. We'll have to get to that. That's not the same. Okay?
Is there an objective criteria for quality of life?
No. Definitely not. I think the objective criteria is up to the person and up to the person, what you know the intentions of the person are. For some people, the definition of going on dialysis would not have been a impairment of their quality of life because they'll be able to speak to their grandchildren, they'll be able to have the things. Okay, they won't be able to control their calendar on their Palm Pilot anymore, but they still would have experiences. That's why I was not ready to Paskin that he could stop dialysis. But this person felt that his total quality of life was, and I felt that was totally on the envelope of being of whether that's permitted or not. That's why I wasn't willing to Paskin on it.
But lacking a person's unconscious, you have no written statement for this, so then...
Then you have to look at the siblings and spouse and see where they're at with it. And by the way, most hospitals now encourage some type of living wills and stuff like that, and I've included two as part of this handout so that we can go through that. And most hospitals won't take, unless the person was rushed by emergency, but if the person is going in for a medical procedure, they require that a living will be completed beforehand, so that Rabbi Hoffman's concern is not one that needs to be totally developed because it's written in the will or the healthcare proxy what the person wants in their definition of quality of life. But the dialysis case is by far the most extreme case I've ever experienced. But for the most part, you can have a situation where a person simply, all they can do is breathe and they get fed intravenously. For some people, they're still comfortable with that because they can still see their loved ones. For others, they don't want to be mutured like that. I don't know how many of you have had experiences that your parents have had to deal with your grandparents and their end-of-life issues. And your parents will whisper in your ears, please don't let this happen to me. Because no one wants not only not to be a burden on their children, but no one wants, who is active and stuff like that, they don't want to be, that's not the way they want to go. There's mazel even the way you die. Yes?
Where do we see that the way that they want to go is what binds a person in terms of lo tama and pikuach nefesh.
Okay, so let's go through the Igros Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman, and I think maybe you'll have a little bit more clarity on that issue. Thank you for leading us there. Yeah.
Sorry, they just recently passed a law in Israel, and it supposedly was okay by several Orthodox rabbis, but on ways to disconnect life support in our halakhic.
Well, what they do with the disconnect the life support, they don't disconnect the life support. What they do is, I don't think they do that either. Again, I haven't seen the thing. What they do is, life support systems, and maybe Rabbi Schwartz, we can arrange a class trip to this, because it wouldn't be such a bad idea for them to see it. Life support systems work in the following way. you don't, it used to be, and some of the tshuvas refer to that, like Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he discusses life support system. He says when you clean the life support, the ventilators, you don't have to put it back on. Well, you know, there's no such thing as the need to clean ventilators anymore. In other words, the vents can stay on for a very long time. They don't need, they self-clean. You don't need to take them off and then bag the person and clean it and then put the ventilator back on. However, there are different percentages of oxygen on the ventilator. The person's on 30% oxygen, the person's on 40% oxygen, the person's on 100% oxygen. So then the halachic question, which I believe that article was dealing with is, but I don't remember it, but I know that this is an issue, is can you say that not to increase the amount of oxygen on the respirator, is that permitted or not? And I believe that the answer to that question is yes, because you don't have to do something heroic, additionally heroic. In other words, if the person's going to die when they're on 30% oxygen because they're breathing on their own partly and they just need a little extra help, but now their situation's become so much more critical that they need 100% oxygen. Well, if you feel there's no quality of life, maybe you don't have to increase the settings of the respirator.
Beyond a normal person.
What?
Beyond what a normal person has.
Well, yeah, what a normal person has, beyond what that person has now. You couldn't decrease it, because by decreasing you'd be killing them in an aggressive way. But you don't have to increase it. In other words, let's say the person's on 50% oxygen. Now they need to go to 100%. So to increase the dial from 50 to 100 is an additional heroic measure. I don't think that is halachically required for one to do. Now, let's look at these tshuvas. Rav Moshe Feinstein, yes?
Isn't that increasing life also? If I'm increasing the...
You're increasing the medicines that the person's getting.
That's also increasing the person's life.
Well, that would be permitted. That would be something we would encourage in case, unless there is no quality of life in which we don't have to do heroic measures. The paradigm introduced by Rebbe's maidservant is that you can sometimes pray for the death. This idea of Rebbe's maidservant then is taken to the point where Moshe Feinstein says that you do not need to give medicines for arichas yamim if there is no quality of life. That's the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein on my page 6. I don't know what page it is in your handout. Okay, page 6. Where Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that if the person's going to live in a state of pain and difficulty by giving them additional medicines, ein litein lo mine refuot, you don't have to give them. There's no mitzvah of lo tamal adam reyacha. There's no avera lo tamal adam reyacha in that case. Elo yanichum kamo shehem. You can leave them as they are. Ki litein lehem sami refuot sheyamut aydei zeh. Ki litein lehem sami refuot sheyamut aydei zeh. V'chein lechos eza pula sheyigur mechad serfi l'rega achas hubachashiva shovim damim. You can't do anything that's going to cause them to die earlier. In other words, you can't turn off the machines. You can't give them medicine that's going to cause them to die earlier. LSU b'sheva atase, but to do b'sheva atase is okay. Avo im ika same merape sheyakilu hayisurim v'lo yikatsru af mereg mechaya tzorich lasos shedayim inogoses. He says, but if there are same merape medicines that will limit the yisurim, then you should do those by giving them medicines of some type. Now here, there is a very interesting issue, and that is that when you give certain drugs, like morphine, when you give the person a morphine drip, anyone pre-med here also? You know any, what?
Yes, sir.
So what you have when you give a person a morphine drip? What happens?
Blood pressure drops.
Blood pressure drops. Correct.
Once you take blood pressure,
well, and also, by the definition of blood pressure drop, the person will have a more shallow breath and things of that nature. So here's a major halachic question, and that is, can you give the person a morphine drip if the morphine drip is being given to him not to kill him, but the morphine drip is being given to him to take him out of his pain?
Okay, so you wouldn't check his blood pressure and then you know it would kill him, or?
You know that eventually it's going to inhibit his breathing on some level, because the morphine drip, especially if the person is in more pain,
and
you raise...
And it may kill him or will kill him?
Let's say it may.
I would say no. Direct cause of the person.
Yeah.
So we paskin actually that you are allowed to still give them the morphine drip. because when you're doing it, I think I put it down here.
Rinpoche says specifically not.
I know. I know that. Did I put it here? Yeah, Rav Moshe says specifically not, but we paskin, there are many poskim that say you're allowed to, if the morphine drip is being to alleviate pain, even though it could have residual effects like the one I just articulated. Let's look at the Tshuva of Shlomo Zalman, see if it's found there. But what we should extrapolate from the Tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein is the following. The question that was being asked earlier, that lo tamod adam reyacha, how do you deal with that? You see, Rav Moshe is clear that in the case in which there is no quality of life, lo tamod adam reyacha no longer becomes a factor. This introduces us to the second piece of our puzzle. Now, while it is permitted to throw away chayei shah in order to extend a person's life, when you extend a person's quantity of life, but there is no quality, halacha does not demand that you take that aggressive route. Let me say that again, and I'll take questions. When by extending the quantity of life of a person, there will be no quality of life, halacha does not require that you take that position. That is what Rav Moshe Feinstein is telling us. Yes?
What was the basis for that?
The makor is the makor from that I showed you, the Gemara Ksuvis, followed by the Ram, that basically says that there are times in which you can pray for a person to die. And since by not doing the aggressive actions, you are not doing a kumva ase to kill the person, but a sheva atasa, you maintain the status quo, Rav Moshe and everybody. Rav Moshe is just a nice person to bring down, but there's no one who doesn't agree with this approach. And that is that you do not need to do something aggressively to cause the person to extend their life when there will be no quality of life. That's what Moshe says, or Shlomo Zalman says it. Most significant poskim will say that. Yes?
How do we define no quality of life?
So that is my point. There is not an objective definition to that. Definition of quality of life has to be within appropriate parameters defined by the person who is ill. If the person feels that their definition of quality of life is that simply being, they won't be able to talk, they won't be able to eat, they won't be able to breathe on their own, but they'll be able to see their grandchildren, and therefore they'll have some life, and that for them is life, then do the aggressive operation to maintain that status quo. If a person says, I would love to see the grandchildren for the rest of my life, but I don't want to live as a vegetable and have no quality of life from the perspective of that I can't eat on my own, I can't breathe on my own, or I can't, and thing of that nature, even though I'll be able to see my grandchildren and even hear them and listen to them and process them. So for one person, the definition of quality of life is different than for the other person.
But then what?
This is.
So how is it different than committing suicide?
Because the definition.
Active versus passive.
Correct. That's it. Yeah.
So in any imagined subjective situation where a person feels that they don't have quality of life, they can eat cheesecake.
I would think that it's no longer subjective. You're right, but
the poskim are all speaking about a case when you have yisurim and sar.
Right, one person's yisurim and sar is different than another person's yisurim and sar. Eating the cheesecake thing. No one would say that. And even the case that I gave you, let's spend a few moments on this. Even the case that I gave you, with a person that needed to have their blood cleaned, you know. I did not feel that was a fair definition of having no quality of life. So what? So for 9 hours a week, you have to go through that. And so what? This guy was a major corporate executive. Everything in his life was organized by him. And now he's going to need somebody to do it for him. He's not going to be able to do that stuff. I did not feel that was a definition of no quality of life. But the person felt very strongly about it. And he was a total Yirah Shemayim. And I did not feel that I should be the guy to come down and say no without asking somebody who I turned to himself. Rabbi Schechter being willing, you know, when it was explained to him, and it was explained to him with the person's children in the room, because the person's children in the room were also, they're all from, you know, some are more like Hasidish, some are more, you know, more Misnagdish, but they're all, you know, Shomer Torah mitzvahs fully and everything else of that nature. I wanted them to be able to add any nekuda that they wanted to the discussion so that they all felt that they were involved in the process and they never would feel bad no matter how the psak came down. That to me was very important. So it was done on speakerphone, which is not the best way to have conversations of life and death. But I thought that in this case it was the appropriate way. So for me, that was a very, and that's why I'm sharing you this discussion. And again, it would be easy for me to only share with you the limited conversations, but I wouldn't be doing you a service. That to me was the outer extreme of anything that I would ever consider no quality of life. Even till this day, I'm challenged with that experience. But that's, and I shared this with you, I think the last time we met, that's the relationship between a rav and a posek. A rav needs to have a posek, which does not mean, again, that the rav shouldn't learn the sugyas, shouldn't be holding in the sugyas, and shouldn't feel competency in the sugyas. But it's when questions like that happen that the rav should also have somebody that they can ask. And it doesn't need to be the same person for everything, because different people have different competencies and different sensitivities and different things. There could be a time that I view David Pelkowitz as my posek, by giving me certain advice on what a definition of a mental health issue is, and there are times in which I can view somebody else as it, and obviously there are many more times where I view that person to be Rabbi Schechter. But the bottom line is, when there is no, the definition of quality of life, it's somewhere between the no cheesecake to the idea that you can't eat and you feel pain every single day. There is a major gap between that, and even within this room, where people haven't had those life experiences, they should realize that in most cases, in which there is, you know, the person might not be able to walk for the rest of their life, might not be able to go to the bathroom on their own for the rest of their life, might not be able to eat on their own, but eat through a peg in their belly button for the rest of their life. Those are issues of significant issues of loss of any type of semblance of having quality of life. It's there, that's the normal cases. I gave you one case that happened to me over 20 years. I wanted to just really make the point. But that's the norms is what I'm talking to you about now. The guy, you're gonna save the guy, but the guy is going to be bedridden for the rest of his life. And the major concern that they're gonna be is that, how do you rotate the person so he doesn't have bed sores that eats up his body, you know, because he's prone in one position for the rest of his life. There's no quality of life in those cases. Now, there might be some people that say, I have quality of life because I can interact with this world still. That's a very subjective definition. And that's where the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein and the tshuvas of Rav Shlomo Zalman come into context, appropriate context. Yes, yes, yes.
Regarding the implication of the morphine case, the way we posek, does that mean that you're allowed to potentially shorten a person's life because it is his quality of life to not have pain for that period of time?
I think that you have to make sure that you're using the morphine in order to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to protect him from pain. But the minute the morphine drip becomes a conduit through which the person's life ends, then it becomes a din in ritzicha instead of a din in helping the person with their yisurim. And therefore, when the rabbi gives guidance to the doctor about how the morphine drip works, and their morphine drips work in two or three different ways. Most of the ways, it's a timed drip. The guy can have a button, you know, to push for morphine, but as those of you, any of you who've had children before may know that sometimes if a woman needs morphine at a certain time, she might have a button that she can push, but she'll only be allowed X amount of morphine per time, and if she pushes it 20 times and the dose that she was allowed was only after the first time, the next 19 pushes may make her feel more comfortable, but she's not getting any more morphine. In other words, it's a time-regulated thing. So what will happen when a person's unconscious is the morphine drip will be regulated. If the doctor is just using the morphine drip to take away pain, that's halachically permitted. The minute the morphine drip plays a role in which it becomes an agent of death, then it is exactly that. It's a kumva aseir for tzicha, and then it's aser. Yes?
I, The rabbi is probably aware of the source. I'm sorry, I don't know by heart where it is. I think it's just the source that if somebody is dying, but and he's supposed to die without any active intervention, but something is preventing him from death, like
right. So I quoted that in the Shulchan Aruch here,
okay.
Right?
So that probably fits in with the fact that if there's no quality of life, but somebody would die on his own, and then you
right. That's source number four. On page 5, the Shulchan Aruch that I quote, that I have in a box, is that issue.
Right? So
that's the idea, right, that there's no quality of life, and therefore we can't do anything aggressive to cause the end of death, end of life, but we don't need to create an environment in which a person can't die with the menuchas nefesh.
So that extra bag in the IV would be the timing?
The extra bag of IV is not something disassociated with the person. That IV is in the person themselves. Therefore, you can't remove the IV.
No, but the extra that wasn't passed yet.
Right, yes, that would be something
that.
That
would be similar
yeah.
to the wood chopping
yeah.
sound.
Now, most poskim will not permit a person not to be hydrated. In other words, you can't have a situation, I've had many, many discussions with doctors on this, that what they want to do is, not only do they want to stop the IV medicines, they want to stop the IV fluids. That, I think, is forbidden. To starve a person is not permitted to
That's worse than not increasing the oxygen level?
Yeah, I think that starving a person, because you're going to make them go through more yesurim and stuff like that, I don't think that's permitted. So they need to get an IV drip of saline or whatever else that keeps them hydrated. This particularly becomes an issue when a person goes into a hospice routine. Now hospice, the whole philosophy behind hospice, and again, it varies from state to state, and I'm not up on New York hospice issues, nor am I up with, you know, what Jewish components are of the New York hospice, but hospice in general basically says, let's not do any aggressive behavior. So at a certain point where a person has no quality of life, sometimes the family will give them over to hospice, and they won't give them additional medicines, but they will give them medicines to be able to make them feel comfortable. And I had worked out a relationship, I hope it still is maintained, that they always hydrate the patient, and not that they don't hydrate the patient, because in many hospice experiences, they will stop hydrating the patient. In my discussions with Rabbi Shachter and with others, they felt that hydration is something that should be done because by starving the person, you're causing extra tsar. Regarding feeding a person, like giving them a tube, giving them a peg and feeding a person, you have to understand the metzias of the case. Sometimes feeding a person can actually cause the person additional tsar, because what can happen is if the person is not well, the food can rise up and cause the person to start choking. So therefore, and coughing and things of that nature. So therefore it's important to understand that not all the time is food a healthy thing to give a person, the liquid food that they're getting through a peg. Sometimes that can cause choking and other types of complications that can cause the person to die. Let's look at the tshuva of Shlomo Zalman for a second. So when Rav Shlomo Zalman has a few statements, first of all he says, I'll quote what I underlined, but you should read the whole thing. When a person has a lot of tsar, then it becomes, from a halachic perspective, it becomes a mitzvah to mevakesh alav rachamim. He quotes the Ran that we quoted in others. So then he requires. Then he says, "Avo mikom akom oh, but sof sof hachayim shel mishtukim heim." When a person's in pain, or they feel in pain, here again, I think it's very subjective, within appropriate boundaries. You don't have to do any type of operation. Especially in those cases where the chance is that you won't, you're not sure if you'll save the person anyways. Then Ravin mitlaptim b'sheila zu shel tipu b'chol agosei sheish sovrin z'kishem shebechalim shabbos avor chayisha kach chayavin lafriach z'chola al zeh kihu eino ba'alim al atzman levater af al regal achas, which seem to be some of the positions that people in this room. Ach mitstaber she'im acholah sovel mekaavim b'yisurim gedolim o afilu sovel nefesh chazak ma'od. In other words, he's in pain, or notice the language of Rosh Shlomo Zalman, or afilu sovel nefesh chazak ma'od, or the person's having, there's a psychological issue because of this thing. You have to give the person food. Here's the idea, they said, of hydration and oxygen. You can stop giving him any type of trufot. And I think Rosh Shlomo Zalman does not mean that you can stop the bag while it's still flowing. It means that once the bag is finished, you don't have to put any more on. I don't think you can pull off the bag. That's not what he means. In other words, you should try to convince them that maybe they want to have that life. But it's up to the person. So here we do see that all the issues that people were concerned about of Lotam al-Damriacha does not really apply. In all cases, there will be. It is important that we educate our communities that they should have what we call healthcare directives. There are two healthcare directives here. On page 8, 9, 10, and 11, you have the RCA healthcare directive. Quite honestly, it's not one that I use. Why? It is way. Look at all of the questions that it requires the person to answer. And I think that it's very. It's very hard to ask a person to make these type of decisions. I like the one the Aguda put out much better. And that's the one that I've used. Page 12, 13, 14. There's a website, jlaw.com. These are on there. Okay, both of them, 15, 16, and 17. Let's look at this for a second. The first pages are your instruction pages, but we'll skip 12 and 13 because you'll trust me that I know how to pull it out. We'll go to page 14. Your healthcare surrogates. Who are the people that, if you're incapacitated, you ask what your feelings are? You always have one, and you always have an alternate surrogate. That's page 14. Page 15. And here is why I like the Aguda one well, because it's a really nice way of saying it. I like it. Look at Jewish law to govern healthcare decisions. I am Jewish, it's my desire, and I hereby direct that all healthcare decisions made for me, whether by my surrogate, a guardian appointed me, or any other person, be made pursuant to Jewish law and custom as determined in accordance with strict Orthodox interpretation tradition. Without limiting in any way the generality of the foregoing, it is my wish that Jewish law and custom should dictate the course of my healthcare with respect to such matters as performance of CPR if I suffer cardiac or respiratory arrest. So for example, the person has a heart attack, which happens a lot when a person's body is under a lot of stress. There's no quality of life. Can you sign a do not resuscitate order? Do not resuscitate basically says, I don't want to be resuscitated if I go into cardiac arrest. Now, to sign a do not resuscitate order, when you've been in a car accident and there might be certain challenges, that I think would be wrong. To sign a do not resuscitate order when you're suffering from cancer and your body, all systems of your body are shutting down at that point, where you have really no functional systems, then I understand why a person would want to do it. I think it is important for people to understand that often nurses, when the DNR order is there, I have found don't take as good of care of the patient as they do when there is no DNR order, simply because they feel that, you know, people have given up. But that could be hospital by hospital. My experience is I've seen that, but I do encourage, one should realize that a DNR order is appropriate in certain cases. The performance of life-sustaining surgical procedures, that's the issue of Chayesha issues, and the initiation or maintenance of any particular course of life-sustaining medical treatment. That in particular is what Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein were talking about. Or other informed life support maintenance, including the provision of nutrition, hydration, the criteria by which death shall be determined, including the method by which such criteria shall be medically ascertained or confirmed. And the definition of death, which leads into the notion of organ transplants, my understanding is going to be discussed by others, so we didn't get into that. Ascertain the requirements of Jewish law. In determining the requirements of Jewish law and custom in connection with this declaration, I direct my surrogate to consult with the following Orthodox rabbi. If such Orthodox rabbi is unable or unwilling, you know, refer to the following group. And I've always had them put down the RCA as that group. That's group number two. Maybe they'll start putting down CJS, but right now it's RCA. Next page. If such institution or organization is unable, unwilling, or unavailable, then, you know, find an Orthodox rabbi, basically. Reminds the healthcare providers that they should follow the wishes of the surrogate, they should follow halacha, and post-mortem decisions, which I think are also important. It is also my desire, and I hereby direct, that that after my death, all decisions concerning the handling and disposition of my body are made pursuant to Jewish law. So this issue of doing autopsies or anything else of that nature, dissection, it would be predicated on the truth of the note of Yehuda. If a guy died from some type of disease, a flu of some type, a new flu, and by doing dissections you could save the person in the other room who's dying of the same thing. So then halachically, based on the note of Yehuda in the 1700s, it would be permitted. And the issues of tissue sampling and organs and stuff like that should be decided by the rabbi based on definitions of death, and then it's signed and witnessed. And again, some of that is state dependent about how many witnesses you need. That's why the Aguda has created not a one size fits all healthcare proxy, but one that is state by state, recognizing the different protocols of the states. Okay? Did everyone understand what we did here? Okay, let's take some more questions.
So how does the Aguda form deal with all these I want and not want of the
because there are two, the RCA form is it's not, you can't, there's no case that, like for example, the RCA form. I want kidney dialysis, or I don't want kidney dialysis. Yeah, maybe the guy says he wants kidney dialysis, but when there is mechanical breathing problems and CPR problems with the kidney dialysis, maybe he wouldn't want kidney dialysis. They're too departmentalized. And in these experiences, the RCA is, by the way, rewriting theirs. Okay? It's not the real world. Because the real world is not just about, you can't look at any one of these requests in a vacuum. Because there are always other extenuating circumstances and other issues that fall upon one another.
So how about in this, does it mean, does the Aguda form address these questionings?
The Aguda addresses them in a way in which it mandates almost that the patient have had a dialogue, which is, I think, a healthier way to deal with this. And we should all find the time before it becomes halacha l'maisa with our own parents, they should live and be well for many years, to get guidance and directions what they want.
So the children make the decision.
The children normally make the decision if the parents are unable or there's not a spouse. It's important. So I have maybe 100 healthcare proxies that members of the Boca Raton Synagogue have filled out. And I actually called them as I made this transition, and most of them did not want to change me as a healthcare proxy person. But I have them all actually on a disc now, so that if I'm in New York and I get a phone call, I have some information on each one. But I had discussions with each one about their definitions. Now, I'm the rabbi, I'm not the child. So hopefully I've encouraged them, and they've all told me they've had those discussions with their children. But it's important for me to know how they feel. And some have felt, I want you to do everything heroic no matter what, because you never know. What do doctors know? You know, my doctor's told me 5 times that I'm not going to live, and he's dead, and I'm doing great. And then I've had people tell me that, listen, I don't want to be a burden to everybody. And if there comes a point in time where I'm totally incapacitated, I don't want heroic measures done on my stead. So there's all different permutations. And it's very important to realize that what Rabbi Hoffman asked is important to it. There is, on this issue, even though we live in very, we try to make sure that we define things in halachically, in the halachic fashion, which is very much defined, quality of life cannot be defined in a, you know, two-word summary for every single person. Because my definition of quality of life and someone else's definition is different. When it gets to a point that the guy says, my definition is if I can't eat cheesecake, then I don't want to live, then you need to speak to a higher authority and ask if that's a fair halakhic definition. I would assume that no one would consider that. My cheesecake case was the dialysis, which I felt very uncomfortable about saying would be a loss of quality of life, but a postic much higher than me felt differently, and therefore I followed what he said. Yes, please.
On page 5 of the Shulchan Aruch that the main piece of Shulchan Aruch looked at, so the two examples he gives of things you can do that are just being ma'akev to death, or going to be set nefesh, is the chosen case
for
melach halashon, or being ma'akev to set nefesh, mucha la'asir rosham. I'm not so sure, doesn't mucha la'asir rosham sound like you're actually taking away actively the salt? Or
yeah.
So
no, we wouldn't. I don't know.
The salt is clearly nothing to do with
the
medicine
piece.
It's clearly an extraneous thing which works by a.
It's
giving him tsar. What
is more extraneous than the
medicine?
The feeding tube or the.
Because those are mamish connected to his healthcare. The melech is not. I don't know. It's a good question. We should look at the Nosei Kalim on that. Rich Schwartz, have you ever looked at that?
It's a very hard answer. There's a few gemaras in the whole Zohar about. The question comes up like, what's the makor for the Ramah? There's some city named Dvor, which is Gemara Sota, that everyone who would leave the city would die.
Right.
The gemara comes in. So the posting from that might be the makor for the Ramah. If that's the case, they ask the Kasha about how does he talk about, in this case, removing the salt. That sounds like something active. Say, well, no, it's not really more active than walking outside the city because it's like heebie-jeebie world. It's not.
It wouldn't be
connection between the salt and him being alive.
Right. Medicines would not be that. Medicine would not be in that category. That's a good, very good question. Yes.
The example of the dialysis: is a person able to walk, talk, speak here?
He was able to walk. His walking was impaired. His talking at times was impaired. His thinking at times was impaired. But there were times in which he was able to do all of the above. That's why I was very troubled by it. So that's what you ask. That's what you ask Gedolei Torah. Yeah.
What exactly is the definition of goses? I mean,
goses is
death has to be to become goses.
So I think a goses means that the doctors are totally unsure of when the person is going to die. That it could be in an hour from now, it could be in a day from now. It's not like the doctors say, well, the person is going to live for a few days and they happen to die. I don't think that's a goses. I think when the doctors say it could be any moment now, and that definition of moment could be an hour or a long time, that's when the goses falls in.
So any time before that, like yeah, the doctor says for a couple of days, whatever, moving the body, all that stuff. The question we discussed earlier.
Oh, you can move the body. If the doctor would say, let's say we're doing aggressive stuff, so the doctors want to do an MRI on the person. So there are certain types of MRI that are portable, and they won't move the body, because they'll bring the machines to you. But there are times in which you need to move the person. If you're moving the person to help them, then it's permitted to move them. But just to move them, that would be what we're talking about.
But let's say, the whole first part of the shir was about sacrificing chayisha for a potential of longer life.
Right.
But the chayisha we're talking about is only for goses, right?
Now, chayisha can mean 6 months.
Oh, okay.
That's the tshuvas of Rav.
So we're not talking about goses and all those.
Right, no. Chayisha can be longer than that, the goses time. Yeah. You had the tshuva, the mamash says it in the tshuva, it's not the tshuva of. So the tshuva of Shvash Yaakov is Yom Yomayim, but the tshuva of Rav Chaim Ozer was the person's going to live Shisha Chadashim. See that? Yeah.
What do we do?
terms of the larger issue of understanding quality of life, objective, subjective, if the society, the views of the society change to the extent that there's no longer, I don't know if this is necessarily true today, but in the future, theoretically, hypothetically, if the situation were to change where the view on quality of life would be so far removed from the traditional understanding of quality of life in terms of spiritual meaning in life and the purpose of life, that really there's no longer a connection.
Well, I think your question is a little too theoretical for me to answer, but I'll phrase it in the following way. What happens if, due to advertising and other types of images that we see, people define their quality of life differently than they would have defined quality of life 20 years ago?
Yeah.
So I do think that even though I believe that that is a factor in people's definition of life, I do think that you have to incorporate that into a person because there's a psychological issue, as was, I think, mentioned by Shlomo Zalman, that's important. And if it gets to a point in which the person feels that they're not have any quality of life, then the halacha does not require you to be heroic and aggressive to create a situation in which there is no quality of life, even though the person's still living in this world. So I do think that part of the subjectivity of this issue is the fact that there is a variable that is entered in by society that directly affects our definitions of quality of life. I agree with that.
And as a follow-up, is there anything that should be done, not in terms of dealing with individual cases, but in general in terms of promoting a certain vision of...
So I think that's a good question. I think that these issues, end-of-life issues, should not just be discussed by with rabbinical students. They should be discussed with your congregants. And they should be discussed at times in which it's not a halacha or maisa question where they can't think as clearly. I've had a similar class with my congregants on so many occasions, and then you have the opportunity to remind them of how important it is to define quality of life in ways that are not selfish, but ways which celebrate our value system, which is the best time to have the discussion before it's halacha l'maisa. And therefore, they don't feel under the gun or pressured or anything else like that. And I think that that is an important idea. To take these sources and to share them with your congregants is something that I think is not a bad thing to do. I think it's an important thing to do. Yes?
When you're in the situation of deciding whether to do the medical procedure or whatever in order to increase life, let's say the person that cannot make the decision on their own, you're leaving after the kid, I guess this is a less halachic issue, but what happens if you see that two of the siblings can't agree on what to do? How do you intervene?
That's a horrible, horrible situation, and it happens all the time.
Yeah.
So the answer is that what I've done in those cases is, number one, is I think the doctor has a bigger challenge than the rabbi, because the doctor's not going to listen to what the doctor's going to listen to what the children want. And then it becomes, the person who is defined as your healthcare surrogate. The parents have made that decision for you. Because the parents will say, the parents will pick, you know, Rachel or Leah to be the house.
In absence of, obviously, this becomes very clear.
Doctors don't do serious operations anymore without these healthcare proxies because they don't want to get sued. So 90% of your cases will be with the healthcare proxy. 20 years ago that wasn't the case, but even 10 years ago. But now you go to have a child. We had a child 6 months ago. Before they would admit my wife, she didn't have a healthcare proxy. They would not. She had to fill out a healthcare proxy. I don't know how it works. Did that work for you? No.
I never made that decision.
Did you fill out the pre-forms before you, or did your wife did them?
I did them.
And so that's they required a healthcare proxy for what? For a C-section. So my point is that for the most part, I think the healthcare proxies are part of the culture now. Obviously, I might not be, might not be halacha in all the United States or all the world. In cases in which the healthcare proxy does not exist, the only thing that you can do, and I can't give you a very concrete answer, is having a team meeting with the children when they will agree to sit in the same room, because then when these situations happen, sometimes they won't even sit in the same room. But assuming they'll agree to sit in the same room with the doctor, you meet with the doctor in advance and you almost create what you both feel should be the norm, you try to share that wisdom with the family, and it gets to a point. Rabbis from Salvation used to say there's two groups of people who don't understand their power, meaning how limited it is. Rabbis and the Russian police. At that time, Russia was a functional place. So the bottom line is that, you know, the KGB. So the bottom line is that there's only so much you can do. I would facilitate a conversation, and you do the best you can. Yes. Anyone else?
Yeah. If no living will was left, and there is no clue as to what to do, no statement was made, particularly in the case of a young person, God forbid, in terms of objective versus subjective considerations, do the family have any role in deciding the subjective, or do we simply assume a certain objective standard?
I think it depends what the future of the child is. In other words, if there's a chance that the child will really be healed, I think that you should be as aggressive as possible and do whatever you need to do. If you realize that the child at a certain point will not have a chance of any quality of life, then I do not believe you should be aggressive. I do this only because I want to, again, share with you issues. We, Baruch Hashem, have 5 children at home, but we lost a child. And we lost a child, the child was only a few days old. And the child was born with what's called beta strep. It's a group B strep. It's like strep throat you have, but you can have strep in the vaginal canal, and the child can get this virus, bacteria, whatever it's called, and basically the child can be compromised significantly. So what happened was, one of our children was born with this, and you don't see it right away. So like the first day or so, we named the baby, we did everything, and all the mazel tovs, all the stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you get a call from the hospital, and the baby's having trouble breathing and everything else of that nature. And it got to a point where, by that night, it became so serious that the hospital had used a helicopter to fly people from different parts of the southern United States to create a team to do what's called ECMO, which is a very aggressive form of basically what you do is through the carotid artery, you put in a machine that causes the blood and all the systems to happen. It's called ECMO. It's very aggressive, and they spent $1 million in a period of 48 hours. There came a point in time in which we had done everything that we could do, but it was pretty clear that even if she lived, she would have no quality of life. She'd be blind, she wouldn't be able to eat, she would have nothing. So, and they weren't even sure they could save her anymore. So they asked me what we should do. And again, how do you make a decision about your own daughter and feel that you're halachically competent at that point to make a decision about that issue? So I discussed it with Rabbi Schechter. He obviously cried on the other side of the phone. And it came to the conclusion that at a certain point in which it was no longer necessary to do anything anything more aggressive. This was, must be 12 years ago, something like that. My point is that when we were faced with this, we were like aggressive, 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 aggressive. But then when it came to a point in which we saw that there was no quality of life left, I mean, she would have been a vegetable. We realized that with the help of, again, the Gadol B'Torah, we realized that that the hardest thing to do was to have the courage to let go, because essentially all we were going to do is we were going to put a girl through a life in which she'd have no quality of life. The postscript of it was that after she died, we did the research, and if my wife would have been, you can tell whether you have this beta strep or not by if you go into premature labor, if you have a fever, when you are having a child and things of that nature, those are signs that you have it. So we went back to our OBGYN, who, and we asked the OBGYN, will you test future young mothers when they have these telltale signs? And the way you save a baby when they have loopy stress is you just run IV intravenous medicine, and she takes 3 or 4 bags, and that child would be totally functional today if they just run these intravenous bags of medicine beforehand. I mean, we're talking about $20 of medicine, less money than any one of us has in our wallets, could have saved this girl. She would be functional, walking around and everything right now. So the OBGYN said to us that he went into obstetrics because he doesn't like to deal with death, and therefore he's not checking future mothers. That's what he said to us. That was more devastating than losing the child. So my wife actually refused to allow this to be the final straw, so she went to the Florida legislative branch, met a senator who lived in our neighborhood, who was our state senator. His name was Robert Wexler. And my wife told him the story and got practice protocols for doctors passed all over Florida that if you have any of these issues, you must check by law. Or if not, you can get sued. And then NIH worked with my wife and the CDC and getting these practice parameters basically passed around the country. And what happened was, in our relationship with this Senator Wexler, who happened to be Jewish, we got very close to him because of this thing. We tashered his house. His kids are in yeshiva. His son is getting bar mitzvah in January. He's now a member of Congress and will be at the bar mitzvah. But the bottom line is, I don't tell this story ever, really, and let alone the last 2 minutes of a class. When the nature of all of us, when we lose a loved one or in this whatever, is to do everything we can to hold on. And sometimes the most courageous thing is not doing what everybody in this room might think is the right, is to do the aggressive thing. Sometimes the courageous thing is realizing when there's so no quality of life that the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's maidservant is the appropriate paradigm, and sometimes it's appropriate to pray for death, not pray for life. Okay, we'll stop there.
Should we always be going to